So kind of fitting, we're doing resurrection tonight. That's your real hope. We'll get better in bits and pieces, but basically, yeah. So this is one of my favourite quotes, really, of anybody's sort of view of life and death. D.L. Moody was an evangelist, 19th century, who said this. He was being hassled by a reporter, asking for a quote or to say something that he could write about, and Moody was, slightly wanting to get rid of him, and eventually stopped and said this: "One day you'll read in the papers that D.L. Moody of East Northfield is dead. Don't you believe a word of it. At that moment, I shall be more alive than I am now. I shall have gone up higher, that is all, out of this old clay tenement into a house that is immortal, a body that death cannot touch, that sin cannot taint, a body fashioned like unto his glorious body. I was born in the flesh in 1837. I was born of the spirit in 1856. That which was born in the flesh may die, but that which is born in the spirit will live forever." Great confidence in the face of death. And in, I guess, an age which most Christians have lived in, and in cultures which most Christians have lived in, death is so much more in your face than it is for most of us now. I know some of you guys are doctors and are in hospitals and maybe do get to see it more than the rest of us. But if you think about it, for most Christians, even around the world today, let alone throughout history, death and how they faced it was a much more ever-present question than it is for most of us. Life expectancy shorter, almost no chance of all your children surviving. Often you'll get through more than one husband or wife in the course of your life. So the Christian attitude to death is something that really marked them out right from the beginning. And if you read some of the accounts of the early church and the spread of the early church, a lot of the power of the witness was in the Christian approach to death. So for instance, they were prepared to be martyred rather than give up their faith, which to a pagan who had all sorts of different gods was just balmy. Just swap gods. Just say, fine, I won't worship Athena, I'll worship Jupiter or whatever. Why are you sticking with this one god at cost of your life? And of course, the early church, the martyrs could say, well, because he's the only God, and also because he will get me through death. So I'd rather die than give up my faith, completely confident. If push came to shove, yeah, fine, kill me. I'll still be alive afterwards. And so it's interesting, if you actually read the account of the earliest account of the church in Acts, a lot of the preaching is about the resurrection. And for evangelicals, we're very hopefully well-trained, that we're always meant to be preaching the cross. Christ died for our sins. So it can come as a bit of a shock when you read Paul's and Peter's speeches in Acts, that so often it's the resurrection that they zoom in on. And when you read commentators writing about it, it's one of the questions they have to wrestle with. Now, we're not going to go into the theology behind it, and it's certainly not the case that they don't care about the cross at all. There's reasons why they maybe major on the resurrection. But it is still the case that the resurrection is more overtly preached, even than the cross. And it's always been a slight poke at evangelicals that you evangelicals, the only time you ever talk about the resurrection is if you're trying to do an apologetics talk proving the Christian faith. You know, the tomb was empty, can't find the body, he was seen by all these people, so Christianity must be true. Resurrection's true, therefore Christianity. That's a good way to argue, but it's not the only thing about the resurrection. And actually, I think for a lot of the time, we're pretty weak on the sort of so what's of the resurrection. In fact, when you start reading the New Testament, it's all over the place, and there's no way we can cover all the implications of the resurrection, just like you can't cover everything the Bible says about God when we did that a few weeks ago. So I've just cherry-picked two or three, really. Do you just want to find 1 Corinthians 15, which is pretty much the longest sustained discussion of the resurrection? Acts, Romans. So Gospels, then Acts, then Romans, and then you're into 1 Corinthians. It's a long chapter. It's a great... Do read it through. There's a few bombsite verses in there about baptising the dead and things like that, which I've no idea about. But basically, it's Paul's sustained treatment of the resurrection. And it's a fantastic chapter. But we'll dip in and out just so we don't have to read it all. At the time it was written, when the New Testament was being written, the scriptures that the church had were the Old Testament. They were slowly beginning to share the New Testament documents around. But obviously, the only letter the Corinthians had was Corinthians to start with. They didn't have the letter to the Romans and the Ephesians and all the rest. So that their major scriptures were the Old Testament. And in the Old Testament, the Jews were clear that one day there'd be a big day of resurrection, when the dead would rise from the graves, have their bodies renewed, and that the earth would be restored. So, and it was referred to as the day of the Lord, great day of the Lord, when everything, creation, would be renewed. So the Bible's never had this idea that the main hope is that, you know, your body will die and rot and everything, but your spirit will go off to soar and be in heaven in a kind of floaty paradise. That's not a biblical idea really at all. The hope has always been one looking forward in history that one day we'll get to the great day of resurrection. And that explains really why they got a bit confused when Jesus rose from the dead. Because in Jewish thought, the resurrection should happen all at once. And the changing of the world, the renewing of the physical earth, should happen all at once. That's what they were expecting. So they couldn't understand why one man had been raised from the dead when nobody else had. And when the earth itself obviously hadn't been renewed. If this great day had taken place, why are the rest of us still sort of dying and ill and all the rest of it? And there's some confusion about that, particularly in the books of Thessalonians. Of course, what actually happened is that Christ was raised, in the words of this verse in 1 Corinthians on the sheet there, as the first fruits of those who've fallen asleep. When the New Testament arrives, what you see is that actually the day of the Lord, rather than being one big bang when creation is renewed, the cosmos is renewed, and human beings are raised, actually what happens is that the king of creation gets raised, Jesus gets his resurrection body, never to die again, never to be ill again, never to suffer again, but nobody else does, and the earth doesn't change. So the day becomes split into two periods. It starts with Jesus' resurrection, and it'll end in the future when Jesus comes back, we're given our resurrection bodies, and the earth will be renewed. So the Bible ends with new creation. Okay, it doesn't end with everybody being sucked off into floaty heaven, it ends with new creation. But in between, I haven't got a third hand in here, this is where we live now. This is where we live now. So this evening really is about living after Jesus' resurrection, but before our full, final resurrection. The reason I say full and final, we'll discover a bit later. Now, in Paul's thought, that verse, 1 Corinthians verse on the front of the sheets, if Christ is proclaimed as raised for the dead, how can you some of you say there is no resurrection of the dead? But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. The first fruits in the Old Testament was a sacrifice you brought to God. The first oats you grew, I don't know what they grew actually, first whatever they grow in the Middle East, first olives, first grapes, whatever it was, that popped through, they would take and dedicate to God at the temple, or the first lamb that was born, they'd take. And the idea wasn't just that you were giving God a bit of your grape harvest, or a bit of your new crop of lambs. What you were giving him was symbolically all of it. The first one was the head, if you like, the bit that represented everything else. There's a connection between the first thing you gave to God and symbolically that was you giving everything to God. So when Paul talks about Jesus being the first fruits of the resurrection, he's imagining Christ being raised, not just on his own. Oh, that's great, Jesus was raised. Well, great for him, but what about the rest of us? Sorry, this way around. By calling him the first fruits, he's saying, because Christ has been raised, therefore it is absolutely certain that you will be raised too. Christ being raised wasn't just the proof that it's possible to be raised, and so, hey, it may happen, someone's beaten death, maybe you will too. It was an absolute guarantee in Paul's mind that you will be too. He's the first fruits and we're the rest of the harvest. You can't separate them. So what he's trying to get at with the Corinthians is you can be absolutely sure if you trust Christ, you'll be raised too. No doubt about it. One day your body will be changed, you'll be transformed, and you'll inhabit this new earth. He then goes on in this chapter to tell us a little bit, or answer the question, what will the resurrection body be like? Last verse on the bottom of the sheet. The best we can do is this. Just as we've borne the image of the man of dust, that's Adam, so also we'll bear the image of the man of heaven, that's Jesus. What he's saying is, look, the exact nature of our bodies is impossible to tell. People say, what's the new earth going to be like? What's the new creation going to be like? I don't know exactly, says Paul. I can't tell you everything. But what he's saying is there'll be a continuity between now and the new earth. So between here and after Jesus' resurrection. After our resurrection. There's a continuity, but it won't be exactly the same. It will be better. And he uses the picture of seed. So if you sow an apple seed, in some senses an apple seed and an apple tree are similar, but in some ways they're completely different. And he says it's the same with bodies. In some ways what you're like now on earth is similar to what you'll be like in the new earth, but in some ways it's different too. And that's basically all he really gives us. You get things like we're not going to die anymore, there'll be no more suffering, it'll be more glorious, it'll be spiritual, as he calls it, not in the sense of being not physical, because you're always going to be physical in the new earth, but in the sense of being not of this old earth anymore. Will be glorious. Beyond that, who knows exactly? But the pattern is Jesus' body. So just as Jesus was the first fruit, so we'll follow. And you see Jesus eating fish, which is what we can do now. But at the same hand, you also see him appearing in rooms somehow, having not come through the door. So there's something different. What Paul doesn't know, and unsurprisingly, neither do I. What dominated the early church was this complete confidence that they would get through death. Death is just, Paul ends the chapter, death, where is your sting? Where, grave, your victory? It's nowhere. Death gets transformed from being an enemy that is going to get you and finish you off, just to being a doorway to usher you into an even greater life. Now, just to be clear on this, for now, if this place falls down and we all get killed this evening, our bodies are going to be buried or cremated or whatever, and we'll go to what's called heaven. And heaven is basically the kind of an awesome waiting room. I can't think of a better way of putting it than that particularly, if that didn't sound irrelevant. You'll be awake, you'll be in paradise, you'll be happy, all that, no more sin, but you won't have had your resurrection body yet. You'll be with the Lord, but it's not finished. So the saints in heaven in different parts of the Bible say to God, even though they're in heaven, "How long, O Lord?" And they're saying, come on, when's it going to happen? When are we going to get the renewal? So heaven is not the end of the picture. It's not the final story. We're waiting for it on earth. Our friends who've gone before us, Christians who've gone before us, are waiting in heaven, looking forward from the resurrection to the final day. That's what we're looking forward to. And so, again, because they were so confident that this world wasn't all there is, and actually that this world wasn't the best that there is, as time went on, the church began to remind themselves more and more of the fact of death. So you get these books called The Art of Dying. Someone wrote a book about how to die well, and it really caught on, so other people copied. Or you'd get pictures and poems about reminding you that you're going to die, and you see it, don't you? You see I did put one on the picture. Some guy in all his pomp of youth, he's young, he's fit, he's healthy, he's rich, he's well-dressed, but he's holding a skull to remind him he will die. Or you see an egg timer. They're not, I'm sure they weren't egg timers, whatever they're called, like a clock with the sand running through to remind them they're not going to live forever. Or a flower with petals falling off, just symbols in the paintings. You are going to die. And they weren't just morbid. They were doing it to remind themselves that this isn't it, that there's more to come. So just around your groups for 10 minutes or so, have a crack at some of those discussion questions, picking apart some of what we've said so far, and some of 1 Corinthians. The Dale Moody quote is the one at the top. Really at the moment, just dealing with the fact that there is life beyond death. If any of the questions are confusing, shout. Let's do it for at least 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes or so. Kiddo. I've got all my drinks orders in now, so back in the room. We won't go through it all. I'm sure you manage it on the tables. The transition, really, from that first part into the second part is this link that Paul makes that if there's no resurrection, if this life is all it is, then we might as well eat, drink, and go for it. Because you've got one life, who knows how many years, you might as well go hell for leather and enjoy yourself. If there's an eternity to think about, that should affect how you live now. So resurrection isn't just about being thankful when you get to your deathbed that actually it's not the end. Paul's reasoning is not just forward-looking, but also backwards looking. Because of the resurrection, your resurrection, things should change for you now in this life. So much so that he can even say that we should be living our lives in such a way that we would be pitied if the resurrection isn't true. And I think a really helpful question on that is this one that that people have asked. I didn't come up with a question. Would you look stupid if the resurrection turns out not to be true? Would your lifestyle, the way you spend your time, your money, your priorities, would it look ridiculous if the resurrection isn't true? Because it ought to. It ought to. As Christians, we ought to be so pinning our hopes on that being true that it shapes our present. And that's really what we're going to, I suppose, hone in on for the rest of the evening. Time and time again in the Bible, that the Holy Spirit, as he writes, uses the resurrection, our future resurrection, as a way of challenging our present behaviour. And a guy called Francis Schaeffer preached a sermon called Ash Heap Lives. This is a quote from it. It was so famous it got published. Have you ever walked through a city dump? A rubbish dump, that is. You should. When I was growing up in Philadelphia, I would hike every Saturday. To get to the clean air of the country, I used to save a couple of miles by tramping through the city dump. I've never forgotten this. It was a place of junk, fire, and stench. It has helped me tremendously to think back on that place, because even as a boy, I realised that I saw there almost everything people spend their money for. That was where their investment ended. Let me say with tears that as far as material possessions, time, energy, and talents are concerned, all too many Bible-believing Christians live as though their entire existence is limited to this side of the grave. Imagine a man speaking about his retirement. When I retire, he says, I'm going to live in such and such a house. He talks about this house incessantly, so much so that finally you decide to take a look at it. You're surprised to find it a shambles, with its shutters off, its broken windows, and everything grown over. Would we believe that the man really thought he was going to retire there? Well, what about us? We say we're looking forward to heaven, but we let our heavenly home fall into ruins while we invest everything we have in a house that is not going to last. Why should people take us seriously when we claim we really believe we're going to be in heaven? In our culture, nothing has exhibited such folly more than our automobiles. Fairly old quote. Go to a showroom and see the pride with which a man drives out his new car. Then think of an automobile graveyard or a rusting, stripped, junked car abandoned on a city street. They are shells screaming out tremendous sermons against all practical materialism. You're fools, you're fools, you're fools. And Christians, as well as any others, can be such fools with their wealth. I won't comment on that. I don't think it needs much comment. But I hope you can see what he's doing is using the resurrection as a motivation to living now. So let's just go straight back into groups, in fact. Matthew 6, just a couple of verses, looking at earthly and heavenly treasure. Have a good discussion. We'll finish this at 25 past, and I'll just have a few concluding thoughts before we pray. So, 10 minutes on this. Okay, we'll wrap up so we can properly pray for each other. There should be loads to discuss on that off the back of that. And if you've got time to hang around for a drink afterwards, do keep going. You don't have to switch straight away to talk about the weather or whatever. I do think the resurrection is massive. Living the light of the resurrection is huge. And so many of our decisions that we make are basically based on the next 10, 20, 30 years, not the next 150, 250, 500 years. All decisions you make in life, you want to be thinking, is this a good decision? Will I be looking back on this decision in 500 years and thinking, yeah, good call? Okay, take a 500-year perspective. We're all mega young, okay? We're all youth, okay? We're babies, even, whatever. Look right down the middle, and I think you're quite safe, actually, Tim. It's probably more. Yeah. Kidding. Kieran. Yeah. But really, it's huge because, I mean, you pick any of those around. I mean, kids, you know, is the main thing I want for my kids, and you've got to decide this basically before you have kids or before they get too old, is the main thing I want for my kids that they are gospel-believing and going to live in light of eternity, or is it that they're top-notch ballet dancers who can also play the clarinet, the harp, ahead of the brownies, can whatever? And because the pressure will come. If you end up living somewhere relatively nice and all these, the pressure will come. They can't get to youth club tonight, I'm afraid, because they're doing scuba diving or whatever. And it really bites. And to say no, you've got to be dead confident the resurrection's true. What other words there? Work. You know, they say, look, if you share your faith at work again, you're going to get sacked. Well, if my career is everything, I've got to hold on to it at all costs, so I'll keep quiet. You know, those days may come. I don't know. They're not here, hopefully, for most of us yet, but they are for some people. Eternity, is this a good decision in eternity? Getting sacked, losing my job, having to sell the house, downsizing, whatever it is. Well, in the light of eternity, it will be. It's always better to go Jesus' way. So it's just this massive long-term perspective. And what I found so challenging about the Schaefer quote is, if someone looked at my life and they didn't get me gabbling at them or talking at them, and they were just looking at my life, so my family, who I don't have many conversations with, if they look at my life, how I spend my four things, he listed, what was it? Time, energy, possessions, and talents. I should look foolish to them. And that goes for all of us. Something to think about, pray about. And it's never too late to change. We're not going to do the back page. A little bit of home study. But resurrection life has begun now, is basically all the back page is saying. We're born again now. We're raised from the dead now. Our body's not got there yet. We're still frail and feeble. We're not purified from sin yet, but we have new life now, so we can change now. We no longer have to sin. We no longer have to give in to worldly living. We are now raised and spiritually alive. So it's never too late. Let's do these little sheets. Every week we want to spend half an hour on these. As I said last week, we'll stay in these groups more or less, unless no one turns up one week. So these are the people on your table are kind of your pastoral care now, corporately. So do be praying for them during the week. I've found it really helpful this week to take the sheet away and just pray it for the other people on my table. So take them away, share the prayer requests, and keep mission focused too. Again, can I suggest you pray for 10 minutes, just pretty much straight away, for the resurrection stuff from tonight, then look up and do all the rest of it, you know, friends and mission stuff.